This session every afternoon will be an open session for you to ask any questions that have come either from what Martin or I have said up to now. So far it's more or less myself who's spoken. Martin will speak this evening, but also questions about how these ideas or other ideas are integrated into your life through some form of practice, meditation or other activity. So it's really an open session. If you want to make comments, that's fine too. But I hope that in the course of these afternoon sessions we'll establish some sort of dialogue between Martin and I, who are sitting up here, and those of you who are sitting in the so-called audience. Who would like to begin? Yes.
I've got a question for Martin.
Okay.
The first thing would be, if the problem is not there, I will not bring it. It comes often enough. But, you see, I think there is, when we talk of awareness meditation, and I'll talk more about it tonight, I see the creative awareness kind of functioning in two different ways, so to speak. One way, more what I would call the acceptance way, which is you are with the thing itself as it is. And if possible, as Stephen mentioned, let it arise and pass away. Because generally, it arrives and we stick to it and off we go. But it is true that sometimes as we sit in meditation, we might have something that keeps coming back, like a theme in our life, like a decision we have to make. And then I think what I would recommend is what I call meditative creative thinking. I mean, it's not generally advocated in Buddhist books, but it seems to me, you know, we have to deal with things in our life. And so what I suggest is that one, actually the focus becomes that. The theme becomes the focus of the meditation, but the inquiry aspect is to try to think about it in a different way. Because generally when we think about something in meditation, it's fairly repetitive. You repeat what the person says, or you repeat what you plan to do, and you kind of go round and round. And it doesn't go anywhere. It's just kind of quite obsessive and repetitive. And for me, meditative creative thinking is when you focus on something, but in a spacious way, and when you try to think something you've never thought before. So you try not to be repetitive about it, but how would somebody else about think about it? How can I think something different about this? Can I see it from a different way? And so I would do this for 30 minutes every day. So you address it, but at the end of the 30 minutes, this is it. You let it go, and you can take it up again the next day. That's what I would recommend about that.
To move from causality to contingency, which would not...
The phrase that you find in the text, and I don't know what the original Pali is, but it says, what I have understood cannot be known by reasoning alone. He used the word reasoning, but could just as well be thinking. I think he says mere reasoning. The important point is not to take that to mean it's beyond our capacity to think about it or to reflect upon it or to know it in a rational way. That's not what it's meant. The key word here, I think, is mere reasoning or thinking alone. It's the alone that gives us the clue here. Because I preceded that by showing how after he'd done all these meditations and these ascetic practices, he discovered through this memory as a child of being in a frame of mind in which he was very focused, very much at peace, but at the same time was able to apply vitaka and vichara. In other words, thinking, reasoning. But these do not occur, but these in themselves are not sufficient. In other words, the approach in meditation is not about rejecting thought, but it's about applying thought in a very different frame of mind. One that would lead to what you call a direct experience. And this, I think, is very much the key to understanding the Buddha's own experience. It shows that what he found was a way of being that brought together thinking, contemplation, in the sense of one-pointed attention of mind, and also a kind of moral integrity. In his description of that state of mind that he remembered from his childhood, he said, not affected by negative thoughts or negative or unwholesome thoughts, which has to do with a kind of of being somehow morally true to himself. So there's an ethical dimension, there's a contemplative dimension, and there's a dimension of a kind of critical examination. Now these three you find in the classic model of sila samadhi panya, of ethics, samadhi, focus, and panya. Now panya, unfortunately, is usually translated as wisdom. This is not entirely incorrect, but it again tends to obscure the fact that panya is not, you see, when we say wisdom, wisdom I think is the fruit of the practice. Panya is actually what drives the practice. And panya, in all traditions, is really closer to what in English we would call intelligence. The Buddha speaks of three different kinds of panya. The intelligence we acquire through learning is one. The intelligence we acquire through thinking. And then the intelligence that we acquire through cultivation or meditation or practice. And these, I think, form a kind of a continuum. So he sees thinking as an integral part of the process, provided that it is unified with an ethical integrity and a close and focused paying of attention to experience in its totality. And this leads, or led him, to the experience or the understanding of what he calls contingency, causality, dependent origination. And I think I introduced a problem by in bringing in this word contingency. Let's leave that out for the time being. Focusing instead on his own definition of when this is, that arises. Recognizing the relational nature of all experience, the connected nature of all experience, and of how he understands how when certain conditions are present, a certain result will follow. But his understanding of that was clearly far more than just, you know, having figured it out intellectually. Otherwise it would be no big deal. And the challenge, I think, for those of us who are inspired by that vision, are to find the way to experience that in a similar kind of way. Obviously it'll be our experience, not the Buddha's experience. We can't just copy. But I think it gives us a framework, a frame of reference, within which to refine and deepen our own practice. Does that address your point?
I also the creative thinking on states of not just repetitive obsessive thinking during meditation, but more like thinking, like thinking that a little dreamlike thinking, but not really rational.
You mean in term in meditation or in?
In term of meditation.
Yeah, I think in a way what you're talking about here is sometimes, especially in the first 2 days, but again it depends the conditions. We sit in meditation, and it's really like we are dreaming. It's like, you know, it's a very strange experience, because 1 minute you're watching the breath, you're present, and the next minute you're thinking of, it's not rational, it's not logical, and it's just like a dream. It kind of really is very weird. And then suddenly you come to, and it's gone. So I think in a way, when you are in it, it's very difficult, because I think generally it's because the energy has gone down. I think it's more a question on something of the energy, that, you know, for whatever reason the energy is low in the whole body-mind complex. So anyway, the energy goes, and then we go into this kind of weird dream. But what I find interesting is always a coming back to. Suddenly you wake up, and you see yourself doing this. And as soon as you've seen yourself doing it, then it's gone. Unless you're really in a very kind of tired state, and then you will find yourself moving in and out of this kind of strange, dreamlike state. And I think, in a way, just at that level, I would say to be with it. I mean, the thing you can do is in terms of what I recommended this afternoon, which was to straighten the back, open the eyes, look up, and to ask a question. Who is sitting here? Who is breathing? As a means to kind of enliven the whole being in the moment. But otherwise, I just find it interesting to know that moment where we actually wake up, which is a little similar to what the Buddha kind of, we wake up from being caught in this kind of dream. And you can wake up and you see it. You see, oh, this is not real, this is not. But it happens. I think it's important to say, not that it must never happen when you meditate, because it does happen. And I think it's, again, according to conditions. According to certain conditions, it will arrive. According to other conditions, it will dissipate. And so I would say in 45 minutes, you know, you might be 10 minutes, you might have like this, according again to your condition.
So you wouldn't walk with...
Unless you have really specific dreams. Mm-hmm. But my experience with this kind of dream, it happens when I'm really tired and I sit, is that it really has no rhyme and reason whatsoever. There is, like, really, in my experience, no content whatsoever to even discuss or look at. And the only thing seems to be more that lack of energy for this to happen. But again, people can be getting the content is meaningful, is saying something possibly one could imagine. If it really is mistaking, it's meaningful, and not if you put a meaning onto it. Because sometimes I feel that we put meaning onto things which actually does not ask, are not necessarily meaningful in terms that they just kind of dream, state, or thing. But in a way, we want to have that odd thing that our brain is doing in that moment. That's the way I would look at it. Yes?
So very meaning of question. And the question, what arises first, the mind or the body? And we had a discussion about it, and open my eyes and check every second what arises first. And at that moment, I didn't want to try to do anything else, but in that exercise...
It's a good question. The it leads to a long answer, potentially, but I'll try not to speak too long. I was referring to, as I said at the very beginning of the talk this morning, I want to go back to beginnings. And it's quite clear in the first, in the original, earliest text we have, dependent origination is understood as a linear causal process. This is quite clear. As subsequent generations of meditators and scholars and philosophers over the next 2,500 years applied themselves to ever more understanding of this paticca samutpada, this dependent origination, it became very much developed beyond just linearity and causality, but without abandoning that. Perhaps its furthest most development you find in a Mahayana text called the Avatamsaka Sutra, in which dependent arising is expressed really in almost mystical terms, where they say that everything in the universe is dependent on everything else in the universe simultaneously and all the time. There's no linearity there at all. And the image of that vision is a bit like William Blake, you know, to see to see eternity in a moment and infinity in a grain of sand and all this kind of stuff. And the Buddhist image is that of the jeweled net of Indra, which is this vast net with these reflective jewels at each interstices, each of which reflects everything else. Now that's a very, very beautiful and poetic way of articulating the idea of dependent origination. But I don't know whether it's terribly practical. What the Buddha was concerned about was actually recognizing the sequence of events that lead up to our causing ourselves pain, and how we can actually understand that and break that pattern. So I mentioned the 12 links, for example. Now the 12 links are phrased very much within a linear sequence, but I don't think the Buddha was primarily concerned with presenting a theory of the nature of reality. I think the Buddha was concerned primarily with finding a way or a method whereby to stop doing those things that cause us pain. I think we have to be very careful here. Later Buddhism becomes much more philosophical, mystical, poetic, which all have their great advantages. But there's a shift, I think, towards seeing dependent origination as a way of explaining how the world is the way it is, as a theory of being, of existence. Whereas I think the early texts, which go back to the historical Buddha, are not at all concerned with these kinds of questions. The Buddha is primarily concerned with healing those things within ourselves that cause us to suffer. And his methodology is about seeing how A leads to B, B leads to C, C leads to D, and D leads to feeling miserable. So what can we do about that? I think we have to see this more as a strategy, as a kind of technique, if you wish, rather than an attempt to describe things the way they are. That's another story that the Buddha's not too interested in. But even in the early model, the 12-link model, there are two of those links which he sees as being interdependent, not linear at all, and they actually come right back to your point. If you remember the 12 links, it says actions give rise to consciousness, consciousness gives rise to name and form. This is the classic model. But what's interesting about those two links is that in other suttas, also in Pali, the Buddha turns it the other way around. And he says name and form give rise to consciousness, not consciousness gives rise to name and form. And that, I think, is a recognition of how there is not a strict linear causality between body and mind, that the two are utterly and always linked in with one another, and you cannot say which comes first and which comes second. That seems to be seen very early on, before we get to the rarefied heights of Dzogchen and so on. I could go on further, but I won't. We might come back to this, but if you take dependent origination as E equals MC squared, you find that it spreads out into a whole variety of reflections on the nature of human experience, which necessarily cannot be confined just to a simple causal explanation.
And I think that as an experience, and to me this is one of the great things about meditation, that we can see how the mind, the heart, and the body are inextricably linked and influence each other all the time. And in a way, that I think why it's so important to be aware of, try to be aware in different way, at different level, of all these different three things coming together, and then coming together with the environment. Because generally one is not, it's not just a thought, it's not just a feeling, it's not just the sensation, it's not just outside, it's not just inside, it's all these things coming together. I think the meditation helps us to see all these things coming together and how maybe we can think in some way about this.
It drives us as human beings to be anything other than, what did you say, just vegging out.
Yeah.
In other words, just sitting around doing nothing. Yes, well, I think, again, this is the sort of question that is more interesting for each of us to hold as a question than for me to pronounce some answer to. I think there are many reasons. A core one is basically getting to a point in our lives when we feel somehow that everything we've done, everything we've practiced and thought about has actually not really brought us the kind of fulfillment or completeness that we suspect might be possible. In other words, suffering or dissatisfaction or frustration or pain in ourselves or within the world. We get to a point of sometimes of a kind of crisis, a turning point, a crossroads in our lives, where a question comes up for us that we just can't answer. And that's often the starting point, that's often the trigger. But again, I think it's very difficult. It's such a central question for each person that what is more, I think, important is to cultivate within the practice a clearer sense of why it is that we do this here. It's very easy in any kind of spiritual discipline to lose sight of the sources of our own inspiration. In other words, we come, let's say, we get to this crisis point in our lives, for some reason or another we end up going on a meditation retreat, and sometimes there's an extraordinary moment at which we say, yes, I feel for the first time in ages to have found something. This seems to be opening me up to a way of understanding myself in the world I've never really considered before. There's a great sense of of discovery, a great sense of coming home is often the metaphor that's used. But we probably all know that that too can become another routine. And you can then do 10, 20, 30 meditation retreats, and sometimes you get to a point where it doesn't really seem to be going anywhere anymore. You're going through all the motions, you're quite good at it, you can sit for hours on end in a perfect posture, you can be terribly mindful, but somehow the juice has gone out of the whole thing. It's just another kind of repetitive activity. And in those moments, I think it's often very useful just to stop and to ask yourself, but why am I doing this? Why do I repeat these things all the time? To try once more to reconnect with those primary questions that drove you towards the practice in the first place. I sometimes feel that the most vital time in our spiritual life is that time when we feel the most confused, when we really feel bewildered and lost. There's often a truthfulness in that we leave behind when we become more concerned with sorting out Buddhist philosophy or whatever. And we get more interested in that and we lose touch with that raw human experience of bewilderment, of confusion. But there's something very powerful about that. Very powerful. In the practice of Zen, in particular, a great deal of emphasis is given to what they call the great doubt and the cultivation of doubt and uncertainty and confusion. Because there's a recognition that the power of confusion, especially when we feel it in our bodies, is actually somehow resonating at the pitch of understanding or enlightenment itself. And there's a phrase in Zen which says, great doubt, great enlightenment. Little doubt, little enlightenment. No doubt, no enlightenment. In other words, there's a correlation between the extent to which we can acknowledge our confusion and the extent to which we can wake up. Religion, belief systems, often serve to neutralize that confusion and to substitute it with belief. Oh, I believe in Buddhism and enlightenment and the Eightfold Path and blah, 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 which is fine. But sometimes we achieve that faith at the cost of losing the vitality of doubt.
And in reference to dependent origination, I wonder how genetic DNA, inheritance of physical characteristics, maybe character features, is.
My sense is that if we want to understand dependent origination today, I think we have a far, far greater resource than the Buddha had to understand it. And I think primarily, for me, the great teachings on dependent origination are evolution by natural selection and our understanding of history. In other words, biology and history, I think, illustrate in concrete detail how one thing, when this is, that arises, is very crude in a way. But the ways we now understand the evolution of life on Earth through such mechanisms as random mutations and all this kind of thing, to me, is a concrete illustration of dependent origination. And I think we can learn an enormous amount about that. Dependent origination is just a kind of a template, if you want. And I think that template can be can contain historical consciousness as well as biological understanding. All of these things, I feel, illustrate the principle that the Buddha understood in a way that's not at all abstract, in a way that can actually be verified and falsified scientifically, and a way particularly in the West, in the through how we understand the evolution of ideas, the evolution of societies, political systems. All of these we can see as instances or descriptions of this principle of dependent origination.
Isn't there a contradictory aspect to DNA certain characteristics that are not dependent on your life conditions?
Something else, yes. Yeah. I don't think so, no. I mean, I don't think dependent origination just has to do with my own sort of, my own personal life story. Mm. It has to do with understanding how my personal life story emerges out of circumstances and conditions over which I had no control.
Because what is interesting in terms of genetic material is that it is a lot, not all of them, but a lot of them, it's according to the condition. Some condition might wake up that genetic material, other condition might not wake it up. And also, in terms of, you can have one person having the certain gene, two person, and they might respond differently to the condition that might arise. And in a way, the outside condition might help them more than a certain condition. Again, I think one has to be careful of seeing the genes as like fatalism, you know, and as being totally determined. Generally, again, it depends on the other condition that comes with that.
I think Buddhism, if anything, has the problem of being somewhat too giving too much priority to subjective experience, and thinking that we can understand everything about ourselves through understanding our minds. But nowadays I think we have to acknowledge that our minds, our experience is rooted in the physical organism, which in turn is the result of millions of years of development and change. I think Buddhism needs to embrace the material world in a way that heretofore it has not done, and to acknowledge that me or Martin or you are, as it were, the result of millions of years of evolution, of the kinds of societies that have produced us, and that we are inextricable from that network, that nexus of causes and conditions. And that, I think, also can instill a certain humility, that we don't, I think, have the power to break free from that in some sort of mystical way. But, as it were, we are called upon to acknowledge our rootedness in this physical reality.
Yeah, yes, as I see it. And I don't know if you plan to continue.
I'm going to continue in a sort of development from today, but maybe not in the way that you want me to. I don't know.
Explain what I mean. Because one thing that you start to develop is the idea that we practice today some religions or philosophies or psychologies that were created.
Mm-hmm.
Another idea was the idea that we have this need for transcendence.
Yeah, transcendence.
Transcendence. And the third was the story of the Buddha and dependent origination. And I haven't seen the link between those three ideas yet. And I thought maybe you're going to continue tomorrow, but I just wanted to make sure.
And these are three themes that will be like three threads of a rope. We'll keep on getting back to all of these things. They're all part of the same picture. And I'm not going to now, tomorrow, jump into something entirely different. No, don't worry about that.
So these three threads are what is on Stephen's mind at the moment. So they will be presented in many different ways throughout the week. So sometimes it will be more about modern, looking in a modern way, sometimes back to looking at the origin, then looking at, you know, but you really were listening this morning and really got the three threads which will be throughout the retreat.
The longing for transcendence.
Yes, I completely understood what you said, this place that is eternal and clean and nice and unchanged. Wouldn't you say that this is a bit corroborated by experience, by religious experience? They fall into states of where they feel some sort of eternity or the deathless. The deathless, this name didn't come out of nowhere. It's some metaphor for something that somebody said. Somebody said that he's touching something that he can't say really anything about because he can't really understand it, and it's widening and
well, we'll come. This is a point I'll address very explicitly tomorrow.
I have no trouble with quite a few of those words, but it was getting a little. Even I who generally do not talk about these things, but you have to be careful about saying eternal. You know, that you feel something. I mean, I'll talk about this later on in a practical way too. But you have to be careful to say that it's eternal, because generally you experience it and it's gone. And so you can say, oh, it's always at the back over there. Or you can say, I mean, depending the position you take, which I can understand. But you can also say, it is something that happened because I let go of something. So I experience myself differently. And when the conditions are different, then it's gone. But the condition can relax again and I can be within it. So again, I think it's also a question of interpretation of what you experience.
But I think Thomas' point, though, is that there are any number of great, wise people, certainly wiser than me, who report experiences of eternity, of God, of union with the divine. Now the question, therefore, if I may paraphrase yours, are these people just deluded? or have I got it wrong? And this is, I think, an absolutely valid question. And we'll look at it tomorrow. Which absolutely we don't have time now, but that will, in fact, that's a very good link to precisely what I want to look at tomorrow.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, we're really out of time now. In fact, I think we have. Can you wait till tomorrow? Okay, good. Thank you very much. These sorts of sessions are very valuable. I learn a great deal from being confronted with questions that are not always at all easy to answer. So I'm grateful to you. Thank you. And we'll now have tea. Isn't that what it's called?
Yes.
Tea, light dinner tea. And then at 7 o'clock, Martine will give a talk here.
And so continuing with the awareness, with the mindfulness, with the silence, as we eat, as we work, as we rest.